And we are back once again for the Parish of the Patriots. I am glad you're here. Glad you could join this week. This is the 247th time we're doing this, and still feels fresh, or at least it does for me. Hopefully it does for you. If you do wind up getting something out of the show, pass the offering plate around. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. If you do want to chip something in, just look here on the description page for the show, and you see I got snail mail, Bitcoin, Monero, email address, drop your notes too. If you do have a different cryptocurrency, drop me an email. I can get you an address for that. I'm not prideful. I will take your altcoins because, you know, beggars can't be choosers. Not begging too much, I don't think. But it is appreciated. If you're new around these parts, we do have a Christian-specific segment. The sermon, if you would, that's roughly the halfway point of the show. Sometimes it's very roughly, but it's around the halfway point of the show. And I encourage you to stick around for that. I don't think you'll regret it. Let's jump off in. With that having been said, let's jump off into the listener supporter mailbag. GPT, here's some dough for the show from Mr. T. Thank you very much. Mr. T, I will take all the dough for the show. Don't you know that I can that I can get? Hey, Dan, thank you for all your hard work this year. I know it's a huge undertaking covering for Sven. You guys have done an amazing job. I hope Thanksgiving and Christmas can bring some warmth and happiness to you as the year winds down. From the bottom of my heart, thank you again for your hard work bringing the Word of Christ into my life every week. Thank you again, and that's from Drew, and I'm very humbled. Thank you. Really, I'm humbled whenever I hear from y'all, and I really do appreciate it. It reminds me, this is not all for naught. Now, before I can forget and go any further, speaking of Sven, I did hear back from Sven. So we've got his new mailing address up on the Daily Nationalist show. So I encourage you to check that out and, you know, drop your letters. I use the email service. I highly recommend it. It's really cheap. You can check a deal to where he can reply. And it's just, if you live outside of the UK, I honestly believe the email system is a better way to work. I know some of y'all might be hesitant to use your actual names because you have to use your real names. You know, I mean, it just is what it is. He's in prison and his letters are going to be read. It's going to be scanned. You shouldn't be writing things that, you know, would cause you concern to have them reading it. You shouldn't be doing that in the first place because you could be causing him problems. But I do encourage you to drop in a note, whether you use the snail mail or the email setup or whatever you do. I encourage you to reach out to him. Again, I did hear back from him, so I'm not banned from being able to communicate with him. Thank goodness. I didn't see why I would be, but, you know, the system is kind of insane right now. So anyway, it looks like everything is kind of gone back to normal, and he's in high spirits. It was really good. Like I say, I was really relieved. I was really, really concerned about Sven. You know, when he kind of drops off the radar, they move him to another facility and you don't hear anything from him, you don't know what's going on. So it was good to hear back from him finally and to hear that he's in good spirits and everything seems to be fine. But again, check out the Daily Nationalist shows, Dr. Johnson's or my own. You know, the most recent ones, we got his addresses, his new address up there. And I do encourage you to reach out to him. And it is the holidays, as Drew here mentioned. We got the holidays. We just had Thanksgiving. I hope you know, here in the U.S., we just had Thanksgiving. I hope you got a chance to do something. And, of course, Christmas is right around the corner, which means the year is winding down. We're almost winding down through another year. It's hard to believe. It just keeps going by. Just keeps going by faster and faster. I tell you, it gets to the point you feel like you're just speed running time. Just speed running this thing. Another year is almost wrapped up. I hope that, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into this again as we get a little closer to Christmas, but it is the official holiday season. We just had Thanksgiving and we got Christmas coming up and everybody's got their own situations. I hope you're able to enjoy Christmas coming up and this time of the year. And I hope it'll help serve as a reminder to not forget to enjoy life. You know, it's fine to understand, you know, what's going on in the world around us and how, you know, dire the situation is. I mean, we're not NPCs. We're not these people that go around and act like everything's going to be just fine. And, you know, if we just vote harder and get Biden out of there, then the country's going to turn around and be sane again. We understand the reality. But we should also understand that there's really nothing we can do about it, and accept that. Be man enough to accept that and to do the best we can to live our lives. I've heard people say to me before, they say, you know, when I say, don't get off hung up on like badgering your family with stuff like that. And people, I've had people ask me, they say, well, if I can't convince my family, who can I convince? Well, you have to accept the fact that you may not convince anybody, and who cares? Not to preach early, but one of the things that strikes me about Jesus is, like, you know, he never ran around chasing people trying to convince him. He would just tell them the truth. And if they couldn't handle it and they all left, then he just let them leave. That's kind of has to be one's attitude, I think. You know, so what if you don't convince anybody? You're not going to change. Look, you're not going to change the world. It's good to know the truth, and it's good to speak the truth. The truth has inherent value in itself. That's where I've come to land when it comes to dealing with the reality, the world around me. I speak the truth because I believe the truth has intrinsic value all of its own, just by existing. The truth is not defined by convincing other people. It's not, because the truth stands on its own. If you speak the truth, you've spoken the truth, you said it, it doesn't matter if everybody in the world rejects that truth. The truth still remains. It still stands on its own. It doesn't get weakened. It doesn't disappear because everybody says, no, we don't want to hear that. The truth has intrinsic value of its own, and it's not defined by convincing everybody, because it's a fool's errand. It's a fool's errand. I said this on a recent show. Hell, it might have been last week. I don't know. They all run together, especially now when I'm doing some of these daily national shows. I don't know. I remember I've said it, but it all kind of just muddles together. But you know, I have come to believe that, quote unquote, and a lot of people disagree with this. That's fine. But myself, for me personally, I believe that the idea of, quote unquote, waking people up is a fool's errand. I do. I am now in a humble position, because I used to not be quite so humble. I'm in the humble position now that I don't think I'm going to wake up anybody. I don't think I'm going to change the world. I don't think I'm going to save the white race. I don't think I'm going to do any of those things. And so you say, well, then why do you bother? Because I believe the truth in itself has intrinsic value. And speaking the truth is spiritually uplifting, and it's a part of my own growth. Maybe I'm being selfish. But even if you disagree with that, you're not going to convince anybody. It doesn't make you a more serious person to go around and be miserable. Enjoy your life. You get one of it. You're not going to change the world by being miserable and upset and angry and frustrated. You're just not. I'm not going to change the world with that crap. Go on and live your life. I hope you're able to get together with friends or family, whatever the case may be, over Christmas, and enjoy it. You know, everybody's got their own situations, own family situations, and different kinds of people in their lives. You know, don't be badgering them. You don't got to sit there and browbeat you. Don't be that guy. Don't be that guy that everybody cringes when you show up at the family get-togethers because you're going to go off on some tangent, beating them over the head to convince them, you know, of your views of the world, even though your views may be very much correct. You convince a lot more people by the way you live your life than by the words you tell them, by you know, badgering them. They're just telling you, you're going to have an easier time. And be frustrated. Life goes on. You know, let's go. Life goes on. I don't know. Like I say, for me personally, I mean, it's a much more comfy, cozy place when you accept that reality. That you ain't big enough to change the world. You ain't big enough to change everybody's mind. Wake up, everybody. Wake everybody. Wake up. Wake up, America. We all have our own little role to play. We should be cozy and comfy in our role to play and go on. Live the best life we can. This is what it is. I remember, you know, talking about these kind of, you know, tumultuous situations. I'm old enough to remember. Remember when, if you're around my age or maybe even a little younger, but you were adult back then, you remember the whole frenzy over Y2K? You remember Y2K? mind boggles me that it's been that many years. Y2K, 24 years, going on 24 years, Y2K. But he was convinced the computers were not going to roll over the digits. You know, I was nowhere near as enlightened, humbly enlightened as I am now. And I remember at the time being like, well, why can't they just go in there? Because they're like, all the computers are going to fail because it's going to roll over to the year 2000. And the computers are going to think it's 1900 and everything's going to quit working. You're not going to be able to pump gas. You're not going to be able to do anything. You're not going to have any electricity. We're instantly going to be teleported to the 1800s. Early to mid 1800s even. I won't even have no telegraph. And I remember at the time, he said, well, even then I had enough sense to be like, well, why couldn't you just go in and change the date on the computer and convince it it's 1993? Bunch of people got money out of that, too. Banks and stuff were paying these guys all this money to update their computers because they were convinced everything was going to grind to a halt. And, of course, I woke up on January 1st, the year 2000. Everything was fine, but you still pumping gas. It was a big hoopla. Hoopla over nothing. But building up to that, I remember leading up to that. And there were people that were completely 100% convinced. I would have people come up and badger me about it. Are you prepared? This is like back in July of 99. Are you prepared for Y2K, bro? Bro, something's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be bad. I worked at a business at that time, and I had a guy come in and says, hey, I got to have some pallets shipped in. Do you mind if I have them dropped here? Just leave them back there. I'll come get them. I'm like, sure, man. I don't care. And it is his pallet. And he was buying pallets and pallets of dehydrated food. See, he had built him a compound in the country with barbed wire fences, and he dug him out a little bunker, and he was putting his pallets dehydrated food out there because he was ready. Y2K. These people tell you, some of these people like this guy, they tell you, you know, where are you going to be with Y2K? I'm like, well, I'm going to be in my house sleeping. I don't even stay up. I hadn't stayed up for New Year's like in forever. It's like, well, I'm going to be in my bunker. Don't be coming out there. Don't worry, bro. I ain't coming out to your bunker. Trust me. I ain't going nowhere near your bunker. I'm going to be at my place. I'm going to have all my guns and my ammo. Be eating on this dehydrated fish stick or whatever the hell. I don't know what all he had. And I just never, I never saw the guy. I don't know what. But I just had this vision. Like he's sitting there in his bunker and then watching that clock. 5, 4, 3, 2. And then it clicks over. And the lights don't. And the damn lights don't even go. I've got bought giant generators. And he was serious about it. So everybody was telling him, it's the end of the world, Y2K. The computer's going to go insane. Everything's going to grind to a halt. In a lot of ways, Y2K was like a precursor to COVID, now that I think about it. Because like I say, a lot of people made big money off of Y2K. They did. They made big money off of Y2K. And like I say, a lot of people got sucked into it. They believed it. They got emotionally manipulated into going along with this. And they were convinced it was the end of the world and bought pallets of dehydrated food and generators and big tanks full of fuel and everything else. And then what? Then when nothing happened, everybody else going on about their lives. I tell you, man. Of course, Y2K was kind of, you know, like I said, even at that time, I was nowhere near as enlightened as I humbly like to believe that I am now. And even then, I was kind of like, man, I don't know. It seemed to me like a lot of hoopla over nothing. I mean, you know, you can turn the gas pump on, computer or no computer. I tell you what, you can tear that shell off, and I 100% guarantee you I'll find a way to make a gas pump run. It's not that hard. And I'll be honest, you know, times are a lot scarier now than, I mean, Y2K, I was chuckling about it at the time. That's not so chuckly now because things are way more serious than Y2K now in a lot of different ways. But, you know, at the same time, the principle continues to apply. You know, life goes on. You can go bury yourself in your bunker with your dehydrated food, or you can just go on to town like everybody else. You may understand the world around you better than most people, and you probably do. I'm not sucking up. I'm just telling you, listening to Radio Albion, you listen to my shows, Dr. Johnson shows, the odds are you're a lot more keyed in, clued in to what's going on in the world around you, and that's good. I'm not saying that doesn't have value, but most people don't. And life goes on. You still, doesn't matter in the sense that life still goes on. You still got to go live your life. You can go bury yourself in your bunker, but everybody else going on, going to live the best life they can. Get together with your family, you know, get together with your family at Christmas and have a good time. You don't have to convince them of anything. Probably shouldn't even try, more than likely. It's a funny thing about human nature. You know, we're always convinced of the hard times that we face, the challenges that we face as individuals. We're convinced that they're the biggest challenges that ever existed. You know, that our challenges are the biggest thing, biggest. But the reality is every generation, because we all come and we all go, and we all live for a little while and then we're gone. And while we're here, we got challenges. We got these different things we face, both as a society, but as individual people. And collectively, those issues can affect all of us. But we all face, you know, different things. Everybody convinced, everybody that's ever lived is convinced. I mean, we look around this clown world today, and yeah, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. Lots of trouble. But, you know, if you were a settler out on the prairie back in, say, the 1800s, and your cabin is surrounded by a bunch of screaming Indians on horseback, you know, waving torches and getting ready to scalp your ass, and you looking around and you got your wife and your two kids and one box of ammunition and a rifle, that's you're at that moment, that's the biggest concern in your life. You probably would trade that for our concerns today in a minute, wouldn't you, if you were in that position? The point is, everybody's got something to deal with, every generation. And when you leave this world, there's going to be new problems crop up. It never ends. Your children, your grandchildren, they're going to face hard times. We always have this vision. We wish we could create a world where our children and grandchildren will have it on easy street. We'll have a good, easy, comfortable life, be able to enjoy a quiet, prosperous life. And that's normal. We should hope, we wish to do that. We strive to have a world like that, leave a better world for our kids and grandkids, or at least that should be. That's kind of fallen away. People have gotten so hung up on just getting theirs, you know, getting theirs now. But the truth is, every generation is going to have new problems. They're going to have continued problems. We deal with them the best we can while we're here, and then we're going to die, and then it ain't our problem no more. That's a reality. It ain't our trouble no more. That's not to say we just wash our hands of it and dump it off on the next generation. They can figure it out. But at the same time, you know, there is not going to be some, you know, any generations is just going to have life by the short ones, and everything's going to be great. Everybody got trouble. I guess there was a point here is, in my rambling, is to don't lose sight of the big picture. Yeah, there's a lot of things. It's a crazy world we live in, for sure. But, you know, it just goes on. Everybody's going to have something to deal with. This is the hand we've been dealt. And this is the world that we live in at this time. And at some point, we're going to die. And then it ain't going to be our problem anymore. And the next generation will have their own sets of problems. Problems to deal with. One of the things I had read years ago, I think it was a letter from Thomas Jefferson, and he had been asked, you know, about the new system they had set up, you know, the American system, and, you know, how well he thought it would work. And he wrote back, and he said, well, I'm pretty convinced that we've set up a pretty good system. I think this thing will last 20 years or so. You know, because what he said was every generation has a different set of problems. He said, we set this up. And by the way, those that worship the founding fathers, this kind of stuff that just pew, goes over the head. They deify these guys and act like this was supposed to be a system that's going to last a millennia. He said, well, we set up the best system that we figured would work for us. You know, we had a certain set of problems. We fought for independence from England. We set up this republic, and we set up the best system for the problems we faced. But he said the next generation is going to have a different set of problems. And this system may not work very good for that because it's set up to address the problems we have. He said about 20 years, because he said the next generation shouldn't be bound to the system that the previous generation set up, because they're going to have new problems. So they're going to want to set something different up, and it'll be up to them. We're going to be dead. It ain't going to be our problem. We set up a system that worked good for us. The next generation is going to have their own troubles, and they're going to have to figure out what works for them. And if it's changing this system, then so be it. He didn't have this, oh, we've created something that should last forever. He didn't view it that way at all. I remember back in the day when I used to be on social media, and people would have these hypothetical, I'd get drawn into these hypothetical discussions about setting up a new political system. And you would have people be like, yes, but eventually after 200 years, that system might, and it's like, well, yeah, who cares? You set up a system that works good for you right now and addresses the problem you're facing now. After you're dead, who gives a shit? The next generation is going to have their own problems to deal with, and they're probably going to either tweak what you set up or build something completely new. It would be the normal order of things. But we got to set up a system that will last forever. Then you're chasing a fool's dream, because that's never, ever going to happen. Because anything you set up and establish is going to be run and administered by men who are failed creatures who have their own agendas, good, bad, in between. It's just a reality of it. The American empire is in decline. I mean, it is. It's undeniable. Everybody in the world knows it. We should know it. Previous generations got to enjoy some of the prosperity that brought about, that the American Empire brought about. And we happen to be the generation that's living through its decline and ultimate fail. Look, empires have come and gone. Governments and such have come and gone all throughout history. This is nothing new. I mean, it's a big deal to us because we're living through it. But this is how life works. The American empire is in decline. I mean, me personally, I think that's a good thing. I think things are going to be really tough going through it for everybody on the planet, because it's such a tumultuous time. But I'm hoping for something better out of the other side. What else can you do? You know, what else can you do? You certainly don't want to preserve it. You know, I always laugh about the people with the whole, you know, God bless America and pray for America. And it's like, as a Christian believer, I always laugh and say, as a Christian believer, whenever I've asked about it, I've gotten a real, you know, he hasn't given me anything real too specific, but I get a real hellfire and brimstone vibe from the Lord. I don't think he's going to bless America. I don't see a lot of blessing coming this way. But hey, the point is, this has happened in the past. This is just the times we live in. Empires come, empires go. This one's going. You're not going to save it. You shouldn't want to. I don't know why anybody would want to. It's is what it is. Those that are in power, those that benefit from this system, of course, they're clamoring to preserve it because, well, they're benefiting from it. But their efforts are going to be in vain. They can't stop it. And this, again, I take up some heart in this. These people have power and money and all this, you know, they lord it over us. They beat us over the head. They'll destroy what should be your little somewhat insignificant life from their point of view just because they can. And now you look around and their power and their ability to do these things is crumbling before them. It's slipping out of their hands and they're frantically running around trying to save it. I chuckle because they're not going to be able to. It's all coming down. Forces that are bigger than them. You know, they too have benefited from the prosperity of generations that come before, generations that were honestly smarter than they are now. They've inherited these power structures, and you know, they just believe this just ought to continue that way indefinitely. It's not. There's always something more powerful than you, and outside forces more powerful than them are destroying this country, this empire. It's coming and slipping out of their hands, and they're frantically running around, and it's not going to work. And I take a certain amount of comfort in that. I mean, you should, because again, it's a bad system. These are very corrupt people. They have caused much harm and death and destruction in the world. And then now, you know, now that's going to come to an end. It's going to be tumultuous, but you know, you're not going to stop it. And I think from the viewpoint of an average person, you shouldn't want to stop it. You know, one of the, talking about the decline of the U.S. and such, one thing that's nice that the internet has brought back, because the internet's a mixed bag. I'll be honest, the internet's a mixed bag. I can point to some really bad things that the internet has brought about. One of the first things that props up in my mind, if you said, what's one of the, some of the bad stuff that the internet has brought about? And I would, first thing that pop into my mind is easy access to pornography. You know, I mean, just don't even get me started. I could do an entire show on porn and how destructive it is. It's a mixed bag. You've got things like that, but there are good things as well. It's a mixed bag. And one of the good things that the internet has brought about is that you can actually now, you have access, if you're willing to do it. If you're not going to sit there and pick and choose, and I'm going to listen to the echo chamber. If you're willing to go out and look, you can see how the rest of the world lives without going there. See, back when I was a young man, if you wanted to know how people in, I don't know, Indonesia lived, you would literally have to go to Indonesia and walk around and see how people live there. If you didn't travel, then you are completely unaware of how people on other parts of the world lived. And this gave, to use Dr. Johnson's term, this gave the regime this immense amount of power, because they could just tell you. People in, I'm just picking, I picked Indonesia, you know, I literally just pulled that out of the air, just popped into my head. I'm not picking on Indonesia. But, you know, the regime could say, well, you know, Indonesians live like a bunch of backwards cave people. They're savages. And people in America wouldn't know any better, because you're not going to go there. A handful of people that had been there would sit there and tell you, well, yeah, no, they don't. I was in Indonesia. It's actually a pretty nice place. And it's funny watching, because they try to still do that same thing. You know, they try to tell you that all of these other countries live in this backwards. I scroll through YouTube and they put these weird recommendations on here. And I saw this video pop up. I didn't even look at it, but it was like, oh, why are trains crashing like crazy in China? And it's like, no, trains are crashing like crazy and derailing in the U.S. What are you even on about? But now we have the internet. We actually, if you're willing to go out and, like I said, get outside of the echo chamber and look and see how other countries are. You know, places like Dubai, their highways look like glass. I mean, they have these wonderful highways. China is like a futuristic place. I'm just saying it's perfect. People always try to counter with, oh, yeah, well, look, they've got this problem, this problem, this problem. Well, yeah, of course. If you're looking for heaven on earth, you're always going to be disappointed, because it doesn't exist and it never will. You can look on the internet and see how other people live. Highways is one of the things to me. I don't know why. It's just a weird quirk I have. Highways are one of the things to me that tells you where your society is. And you can watch videos of whatever country you want to look at. Countries in the Middle East, China, whatever. And you can look, and you can get an idea of what kind of highways and roads they have. Now, if you're like me, like many of us, you travel sometimes, especially this time of the year. You got, like I said, we just had Thanksgiving and you have Christmas. I'm going to tell you, if we have third world highways in this country. We do. We're driving down, I'm driving down the highway, and I'm literally having to weave all over to dodge the holes in the road, the places where the chunks of pavement. The corruption's so bad that they go in and they repave a road, and man, it is great. And two damn years later, the road is basically, all the asphalt is washed off and it's in chunks. Y'all know what I'm talking about. And look, I'm living in Texas. I understand if you're up there in Yankee land where for some reason you like living in the Arctic winters, and you can say, well, yeah, well, we have these horrible, harsh winters and the ground freezes and then they dump salt on the roads and it's just harsh conditions and it rips the pavement up. You might have an excuse there. I don't know. But I live in Texas. We don't have winters like that. We have summers. They're harsh. But they pave a road, and 2 years later, you're going over this road that you remember. You're like, oh, I'm going down this road. I haven't been over it in 2 years. I remember last time they had just paved this good road. I'm able to truck down this road. You going down this road, you weaving. You hitting rough spots that are so rough, you're trying not to lose control of your car. Because it's so corrupt. They spend 10 times what it costs to fix it because everybody's got to line their pockets. It takes 10 times longer than it should to complete the job. And it's shoddy. It's 1/10 of the workmanship that it should be. I do. I judge a country's status by their roads. We got third world roads in this country. You can say what you want, but that is the reality. When you know what I'm talking about. Y'all travel for Christmas. Y'all go to visit family. You got to go travel some miles. You know, this is a good stretch of road, and it don't last very long. And then you're back bouncing all over the damn place. And we're talking about America. Boy, I tell you what, we're the world leader. They're just trying to convince everybody of that because it's yet another sign of the empire in decline. It's all going downhill. The damn railroads. Hell, most of this railroad infrastructure was built 100 years ago, maybe longer, and they're still using it. And then everybody's like, why are the trains derailing? Well, because they're riding on infrastructure that was built three generations ago, and they haven't really done anything with it. A little dab of maintenance here and there, and they're still running on it. It's a reality. We live in America, still the best country in the world. And you just don't even want to look. Go look and see. People don't. I don't understand why people have zero intellectual curiosity. You know, because I am. I'm curious of how other people live. They're other people. You know, I understand they're racially different than me as a white American. But that doesn't mean I'm not interested in how they think, how they view the world. I don't understand people that have zero intellectual curiosity. I don't care about those people. I only care about how I view the world. Well, that's a very narrow way to see things. It is. I want to know. I want to know how other people live, how other people view the world. Because when you do understand that, you understand the world around you better. You understand why other people do the things they do. You know, I hear white Americans say those Palestinians are just a bunch of crazy terrorists and how dare they attack Israel for no reason at all. Those people are just savages and animals, and I hope Israel just bombs all of them and kills them. And it's like, well, you know, this didn't come out of nowhere. You know, Dr. Johnson has done multiple shows actually explaining how the Palestinians live. If you were living like those people were living, I'm going to guess that you would have a different moral outlook on the world than you do now. If you were living the way those people live, this stuff doesn't come out of vacuum. You force people to live that sort of way, and at some point they have no reason, they have nothing left to lose. And nothing to gain, nothing to hope for, no future to hope for. Yeah, they're going to figure out a way to fight back, and they don't care if you kill them because they're going to die anyway. The point is, it's good to understand how people live and the reason these things. I don't understand. I don't understand people's lack of intellectual curiosity to sit there and just have this simplistic view of the world. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. And you see this in the media with this Israel/Palestine latest iteration of this conflict. And both sides of the argument in the West have to have this stupid Hollywood version of Israel's the good guy, Palestinians are the bad guy, or vice versa. The Palestinians are like this noble people that are just fighting for their survival, and Israel are the bad. Look, it's not the way the world works. It's in a freaking Hollywood movie. Have some intellectual curiosity. Understand where these people are coming from, why they view the world that they do. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it. Understanding where other people are coming from does not insinuate that then you have to agree with them if you understand it. You can understand, you can have, this works in your personal life. You can have a conflict with somebody in your personal life, be it a friend, family member, coworker, or whatever. Look, you're going to do better if you understand where they're coming from. It doesn't mean the conflict necessarily goes away. But at least you understand why they're coming at you like they are. You know, you're going to be in a better position if you understand why you're having this conflict in the first place, rather than just, nope, I'm right, you are wrong. At least try to understand, well, why are they coming at you like this? And if you do understand that, then you might understand, ooh, actually, I didn't realize this, but I was actually on this one part over here. I was in the wrong about that. One of the most cringe things is, all of you well know, one of the things you want to make me cringe, anytime I read or hear somebody talk about Judeo-Christian values, and not a single damn one of them can explain to you what the hell that even is. It doesn't exist. Where does the Judeo part fit in? I read an article. I got to wrap this up, get into the Christian specific segment. But I read an article the other day and I couldn't get through it because, you know, like in paragraph two, they started throwing around Judeo-Christian. And I tried. I tried to soldier through because, again, I want to know where other people are coming from. And by about paragraph three or four, they tried to follow their Judeo-Christian thing up with, well, the Old Testament. They said something along the lines of the Old Testament, which is the Jewish Bible, and just no mention of the Talmud. The Old Testament, which is the Jewish Bible, and this fits in with his narrative that Christians and, you know, a lot of Christian churches in America have, that like the Jews are sitting around following the Old Testament. And it's like, what part of the Old Testament says you sling a chicken around and your sins go off into the chicken, and then you've tricked God and you're the Old Testament, which is, you know, the Christian Old Testament, which is the Jewish Bible. What part of the Old Testament does the quote unquote Jews of today, what part of that do they follow? They can't point it out to you. They just throw that out there. Explain these Judeo-Christian values. They can't. They don't have any intellectual curiosity to figure it out and say, well, you know, what part of that? No mention of the Talmud. If it's, this works on people because by and large, they don't have any intellectual curiosity. You can go find the information. You say, well, what does this mean? What are these shared Judeo-Christian values exactly? Where's the commonality? People don't know. Then they throw this term around. Judeo-Christian value. You know, in Islam, you know, at least Islam views Jesus as a prophet. They hold him in high esteem. Most of these American Christians, especially the Christian Zionist evangelical variety, they don't know that. Islam views Jesus as a great prophet, right up there with Muhammad. Now, obviously, I'm not a Muslim. I don't do any of that Muhammad stuff, but I do have enough intellectual curiosity and I'm secure enough in my faith and in my beliefs to where, you know, I can listen to where these people are coming from and read some of this stuff and understand that this is the way they view the world. That's a lot better than sitting there going Judeo-Christian, because I'm going to tell you, Islam views Jesus as a prophet, right up there with Muhammad. And let's just say the Jewish Talmud has a very different sort of view on Jesus. So where is the Judeo-Christian part? Where does that all come together? It's not. It's just a marketing slogan like every damn thing else in this country. It's just a marketing slogan. That's it. And people buy it. Americans, they want to, their beliefs need to fit on a bumper sticker. They need to fit on a marketing slogan. And then they'll buy into it just like they buy into any other product. And in this, they're able to just be manipulated. I realize we just kind of been, I'm sorry, I loop y'all in. Y'all don't have nothing to do with it. Y'all just had to sit through it. I've been rambling probably more than usual. Hope you enjoyed the ramblings. I hope it kind of made you think about something. I don't know. But we're going to get into the heart of the show. We're going to get into the Christian-specific segment. So without further ado, I think it'll be more interesting, by the way. Less rambling, I promise. Less rambling in the Christian-specific segment. You know what to do? Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. I thought this week we'd talk a little bit about how to handle emotionalism. You know, I always say, we always talk about here that, you know, the Bible doesn't refer to empty emotionalism and it refers to action. The fact of the matter is we are human beings and we're going to feel emotional about things. our entire societies, because they have become feminized, are surrounded and place all emphasis on emotion. Everything you see on TV, all of these narratives they promote, it's always an appeal to emotion continually. Well, you should side with this people over against these people because look at these pictures. Look at this story. Emotionalism. And it's a manipulation, of course, but we do feel emotions. And that, you know, obviously that's part of being alive and being a human being. I believe the key to it is learning, you know, to face them head on and control them, not shut them out and pretend they don't exist, but to control them and not let your emotions control you. I see a lot of people that get into trouble, men, grown men, get into trouble because at the end of the day, they let their emotions take them over instead of them being in control of their emotions. Now, again, you can't deny your emotions and become a robot and I don't have any emotion. You know, I'm going to pretend you're Mr. Spock or some crap off of Star Trek. Like you don't have any emotions. You know, the Lord never wants you to lie, not to yourself or to him or anybody else. So you shouldn't lie to yourself and you know, pretend that you don't feel emotions. You do. You just have to look at them, acknowledge them, and make sure that you're not making decisions that are just being driven by your emotions. And sometimes this takes time. You've got to take some time. I also think what I wanted to talk about today, we can get into a little bit of understanding, you know, where faith plays its role. And then in the New Testament, you know, the apostles were instructed, they say, you know, pray and when one of you is sick and pray and they will be healed. And you have churches that really center their entire focus of their churches around faith healing. You know, they'll pray and lay hands on somebody that they be healed. You'll be healed. You see some of those TV guys and they do this shtick and have a guy come up on the stage and they put their hands on, be healed, and they fall over and then they jump up and they say they're healed and other assorted things. And don't get me wrong, that has a place. But what is that place? Because Jesus never said that, you know, you're never going to grow old or die. So if somebody is very old and at the end of their lives, are you supposed to put your hands on them and pray that they be healed? Well, some of these churches do that. And they'll pray that brother so-and-so is 95 years old, that he'll be healed of this. But brother so-and-so is at the end of his life, and that's the reality. I think we can fit this in here as well, because my problem with that, obviously, it is not only because it's misguided, but it can undermine people's faith. If you center your entire doctrine of your church around faith healing and you can put your hands and pray and these people will be healed and you got trust in God and nobody else, and you do all of this and then brother so-and-so who's 95 years old dies anyway, those who have weak faith are going to sit there and say, well, this doesn't work. And if your entire belief system is centered around that one thing, then that could undermine your faith. I realize that, you know, not all of these things we talk about are going to apply to all of you. But bear with me, because like I say, I thought we'd discuss something today that kind of is going to cover all of those bases. I just kind of wanted to get a general, kind of lay down a general, I don't know what I'm going to say, context here to kind of keep in the back of your mind as we talk about today's topic. I'm not going to read it, because that's boring for y'all and it's kind of long. But in 2 Samuel chapter 12, you know, everybody is familiar with the story of how, you know, David got in trouble by committing adultery with one of his guy's wives and then even doubling down on that by having this man killed so that he could have the guy's wife. You're pretty familiar with that. And that's covered in 2 Samuel chapter 12. However, I wanted to discuss not that, but I wanted to discuss the fallout from that. When he cucks this guy and he actually winds up breeding his wife, he winds up impregnating the other man's wife. And this led to all of the poor decision making, to say the least, of having this man killed off to hide the fact, you know, he wasn't going to be able to hide the fact that he had committed adultery with his wife because she became pregnant. Well, part of the fallout of this is she bears a child. She bears a son. And Nathan the prophet comes unto David, and he tells David that, you know, the Lord is the child is not going to live because I've got things for you to do, David. You know, I'm not going to strike you down dead. However, the child that came as a result of what you've done will surely die. And the child was struck ill. This is where I want to start talking. This is where our discussion really pretty much starts today, is talking about, I wrote down here, David and the dying child. And the way David handles this situation with this child. The child isn't instantly struck and falls dead. The child is struck and is very ill. So you have a time period where this small child is very ill and going to die. Now, as you might imagine, this is a very emotional thing for David. His child is very ill, and he's been told straight out by Nathan the prophet that the child's going to die. So the way David handles this, facing the death of this child, and, you know, this emotion, this emotional storm that he no doubt feels, he puts on sackcloth, he goes to fasting, and he's praying to the Lord. He will not take counsel from anybody. He basically is laying on the floor, laying on the dirt, and just in mourning and in praying and in appealing to God. And nobody can counsel him. He can't be counseled. He just won't hear anything from any of his advisors or anything. Well, of course, they're very concerned about him. Things roll along, and eventually, as Nathan the prophet had warned David, the child did indeed die. Now, his counselors and his advisors, they're very worried. Now they've got to go tell him that the child is dead. And leading up to this, he's so upset, they can't talk to him. He won't listen to him. He won't eat. He won't change his clothes. He won't bathe. He's just laying in there crying and praying, and he can't be consoled. He can't be comforted. And his advisors are there talking to themselves, like, how are we going to tell him? I mean, when the child was still alive, he was in this state. If we tell him that the child is dead now, I mean, it's going to break him. You know, what's he going to do? I mean, he was this bad leading up to the child was still alive but sick. If we tell him the child is actually dead now, I mean, what's he going to do? There's no telling what he might do. He already wouldn't listen to us. I mean, this could be bad. And they're sitting there. They're kind of off in the corner of the room muttering, you know, basically like, well, we got to tell him. But yeah, but if we tell him, I mean, then what? Maybe there's some way we can ease him into this. He perceives that they're over there muttering amongst themselves. And he looks at them and he asks them, he says, the child's dead, isn't he? Well, this puts him on the spot, and they tell him, yes, indeed, the child is dead. And they wait now for the other shoe to drop. Now, what's he going to do? The big question, you know, the big question in all their minds is, what's he going to do now? You know, they're probably thinking about, you know, we may have to run and tackle him. Maybe he's going to throw himself out a window. We don't know. He was unconsolable during all of this. And now we've told him that the worst has happened. And to their dismay, he gets up, goes and takes a bath, changes his clothes, goes and prays in the house of the Lord, comes back out and tells them, bring me something to eat. Bring me something to eat. I'm hungry. I ain't ate in days. Bring me something to eat. He done cleaned himself up. And they're dismayed at this, because this is like backwards. You know, now he's supposed to be, you know, when somebody dies, this is when you're supposed to be mourning and grieving. And he was doing that before the child died, and now the child's dead. And he's like, give me something to eat. I done changed my clothes. I've done washed myself. I got things to do now. I got to move on. I got to keep on trucking. I got to keep moving on. And they were perplexed at this. And they said, what sort of thing is this? What are you doing? This is not what you're supposed to do. You put on this big thing about not wanting the child to die, and then we tell you the child's dead, and you get up and clean yourself off. Like, you know, I imagine some of them were like, are you fronting? Were you fronting this whole time? You know, were you just putting on a show? You know, I'm sure some of them wondered that. Were you just putting on a show? We don't understand. You were making such a drama out of this thing and fasting and wouldn't eat and wouldn't talk to anybody and all of this. And now we tell you the child's dead and you go this other direction. You get up, take a bath, put on some clean clothes and tell us to bring you something to eat. And David explains to them, as long as the child was alive, who knows? You know, as long as the child was alive, there was a chance that God might choose to just be gracious to me. God might choose to spare the child after all. God might say, might decide that he's going to do something else and decide to spare the child. He might hear my pleas. He might see my mourning and spare the child. But he says, now the child's dead, there's nothing else to be done. God has chose to do what he's going to do. Now we have to deal with it. Now I have to deal with it. I have to deal with this reality. When people get overcome and they let emotions start driving them and their decision making, they stop dealing with reality. Now they're only dealing with emotionalism. They quit dealing with reality. They aren't able to face reality. All they're doing is just being driven now on a sea of emotions, on waves crashing around, and they quit dealing with reality. And as a result, they make really bad decisions. David, on the other hand, said, look, I mean, the child's dead now. There's nothing I can do beforehand. Yes, this was the time to pray and appeal and show how sorrowful I am. And perhaps, you know, God would relent and God would be gracious to me and spare the child. But now you come and you tell me the child's dead. Well, what good does it do me to continue doing this? This is just self-harm. And, you know, beyond this point, it's just self-harm. See, beforehand, I was appealing to God that perhaps he might show mercy and bless the child with being able to live. But now that God has made his decision final and the child is dead, well, anything beyond, if I continue this now, it is only self-harm, and that doesn't help anybody. You see, he continued, he handled his emotions. He wasn't putting on a front. It wasn't a show. But he was, though he was feeling these emotions the entire time, he was in control of his emotions. And as such, when he got news that the child was indeed dead, he was able to just get up, clean himself up and say, okay, that's that. Now we've got to keep on moving and we got work to do. We got to, you know, God has chosen to do what he can do. Child's dead. He said, what can I do? Can I bring the child? He asked some the guys, he says, can, you know, if I continue grieving and mourning and fasting, he says, am I going to bring the child to life? He said, eventually I will go where the child is. That's where I'm headed. I'm headed to death as well at some point. But for now, I got stuff to take care of. I can't bring the child. All my grieving and mourning is not going to bring the child back to life. This demonstrates is David did not let his emotions get control of him. He was emotional, but he remained in control, and he kept, and because of this, he was able to keep dealing with reality. So that when they came and said the child's dead, he was able to deal with that. He stood up, cleaned up, and said, okay, this is the next thing we got to do now. We got to keep on going here. Life goes on. The reality is we're all human beings, and we're going to deal with emotions. We have emotions. You know, does you no good to try to deny those emotions or pretend they don't exist or pretend you're above them? The secret is you can't let your emotions master you. You're going to feel things and you're going to be dealing with things in your life, but we can't let those things get control of us. And a good metric for that. It is to look at yourself and say, are you dealing with reality? You know, or are you dealing with reality, or are you starting to just build an emotionally driven fantasy world in your mind? Or when you look at a situation, when you are faced with a situation such as David was, if David's faced with this situation, you can bet while he was grieving and mourning and covered in dirt and entreating and hoping the Lord would show mercy on this child, you can bet that in his mind he was thinking, okay, well, what if God doesn't? How am I going to handle that? Well, I'm going to go on. I mean, what else is there to do? You know, I'm going to be taking that next step. In other words, he was dealing with reality. If you're dealing with reality, you're in control of your emotions. When you stop dealing with reality and you cannot face reality, you just can't take it, and you won't even look at reality because that's just too unpleasant. And when you're not feeling it, that sounds ridiculous, but you understand what I'm talking about. I've been there. You've been there at some point in your life. If you've lived long enough, you yourself have been there, and you've seen other people be there. You know, some guy, I read a story the other day, news story, and some teenage young man, you know, he broke up with his girlfriend. She didn't want to have anything to do with him anymore. And he wound up going over to her house and killing her. I don't really remember the whole story, but he did go over and like killed her. I think killed her mom. And I don't remember if he killed himself too. See, there is an extreme example of somebody who could not deal with reality, who could not face their emotions, whose emotions were driving them, whose emotions had completely consumed them. When some young woman says, well, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore, and you just give yourself over to that, you can't face the reality, well, that's over then. When you can't deal with that, and to the extreme point that you do something like that, you see, you're not making those decisions. Now you're just letting your emotions, you know, swamp you. Emotionally driven decisions are never good. They're never good decisions. Now, again, you're going to have to deal with emotions. So there are going to be times that you make decisions while you are feeling emotions. That can't be helped. But decisions that are being made while you're being driven by emotion are not going to be good decisions. Car salesmen, I've told this before, but car salesmen are trained to get you to emotionally manipulate you, to get you feeling, you know, an emotional attachment to the car that they want to sell you. They're trained to do that. They'll tell you, they'll take you for the test drive, and they'll start slowly slipping in, you know, referring to it as your car. Boy, you know, this car, your car would be great. You know, this boy, your neighbors, your friends are going to love your new car. And they want you to form an emotion. They're trying to get your emotions going. Maybe you can't afford that damn car, and that's the reality. And this guy, boy, he's kissing up and acting like your best friend. And he creates this atmosphere that you're going to be, not only do you have an emotional attachment to this car, but you're going to be letting him, the salesman who's working so hard for you, you're going to let him down if you don't buy this car, if you tell him I can't afford those payments. And you let yourself, and the idea is to intentionally get you to make an emotional decision, because once you sign on the paper, the bank pays them. They don't care if you can make the payments or not. They don't care if you bankrupt yourself. They don't care if, like, 2 days later you wake up and look outside that new car and then start thinking about how you're going to make those payments you can't afford, and you go, this was a huge mistake. They don't care about any of that. You call them up and say, hey, 2 days ago about this car. Yeah, how are you liking your new car? It's great, but hey, it was a mistake. I can't afford this car. What am I going to do? And they're going to be like, just like laugh at you and hang up. Emotionally driven decisions that you make while you're being driven by emotion are not going to be good decisions. Part of maturing is coming to recognize when that is happening, because you're not going to get rid of your emotions. If you have this mindset like, oh, I'll just become emotionless, I'll just become a rock, that's not realistic. You're going to have emotions. You've got to get in a place to where you can get in control of those, and it may take time. So what's important is to understand when, okay, I'm too emotional about this. I'll come back. I may even think about this car, and I'll get back with you. And they're going to try, you know, to continue using the car salesman illustration. He's going to try. If you told the salesman, let me think about this a couple of days, I'm not going to make a decision today, he's going to do everything he can to keep you from leaving that place and thinking about it, because the longer you think about it, the more you can decide that's not a really smart decision. And he isn't going to get paid. He's going to do everything he can, One of the first things is going to be out of his mouth. He's going to say, what can we do to get you in this car today? He's going to try to rush you along to get it done. Now, buying a car you can't afford isn't just a life-destroying decision, but it's one of the things that's easier to illustrate. But the things, same thing applies to decisions that can be life-destroying. If you find yourself making a decision and you have to be able to ask yourself, you know, you have to look at yourself and say, am I making this decision rationally? Am I using my mind and making a rational decision? Or am I just really in a state of emotion? Am I in a state of coveting? Am I in a state of, you know, emotional turmoil, sadness, anger, whatever? And you need to step away. It's just, you don't have, one of the things, very seldom do you have to make a decision in that moment. You think you do, but you don't. Step away for as long as it takes. It may just be a day or two. Might be a couple of weeks. Step away until you get yourself in a position to where, now you may just still be feeling some emotion. Step away and get yourself in a position to where you're back in control of your emotions. You know, you're not going to go like the story I was talking about earlier. If that young man had been able to do that, he wouldn't have gone and shot his teenage girlfriend as if that was a life-changing, should have been a life-changing event. Well, it was then. You know, if he had taken the time to get in control of his emotions instead of his emotions controlling him, he obviously wouldn't do that because that's a really stupid decision. It doesn't make any sense at all because it's emotionally driven. Now, again, I'm using an extreme example with that, but the point is emotionally driven decisions are not going to be good decisions. It's not going to work out for you. You have got to control your emotions. Now, as it applies to faith, you have faith. I referenced earlier churches that really put all this emphasis on faith healing. See, David had faith that God had the power to spare the child if he so chose. But he also understood that God makes his decision and God's decisions are not driven by men. Too many times we get caught up in our prayers. Again, if we're being driven by emotion, and you will catch yourself trying to convince God, trying to change God's mind, trying to basically manipulate God to doing what you want him to do. Why? Because you yourself are being manipulated by your emotions. David understood the context. This is a child who should have their entire life ahead of them. So, you know, he's praying that the Lord will spare this child so that it can live its life out. You know, this is an entirely different situation than, as we talked about earlier, brother so-and-so is 95 years old and has led his entire life out. I mean, what exactly are you praying to God to heal him from? That he's going to live to be 1,000? I mean, what point in time is his life going to end? You see, that, we have to understand that we still, life runs its course, and God's laws, God's natural order is not overturned. We cannot be praying to God to overturn the natural order of things. When brother so-and-so has lived his life out, he has lived his life out. And you shouldn't be praying for a miracle and a faith healing because this is just how life is. You know, your faith shouldn't be overturned over something such as this. This is just how this life goes, and you brother so-and-so has lived his life now. You have to keep these things in context. And in this, your faith continues to be strengthened and not weakened, because you're just convincing yourself that God is going to do a miracle and save brother so-and-so, when obviously that's not the case. I think of this story of how King David handled this. Because it's hard to imagine anything more emotionally traumatic, a more traumatic life experience than losing a child. Now, I hope none of you ever have or ever will have to face such a thing. Is that because it's hard to imagine anything more, you know, emotionally challenging than that. It's an extreme thing. And you look at the way David handled this. And you look around in the world today, like the example I gave, and there's other, You know, there's other stories. You know, somebody's bullied, you know, these young people are bullied on social media, so they go out and hang themselves because they just can't deal with the trauma. There's no, King David was dealing with a whole lot more trauma of a dying child than people were calling you names and saying you're ugly on the computer. But people are emotional now. As I said at the beginning of this segment, our entire society is emotionally driven now because it's become very feminized. It's emotionally driven, and the people are emotionally driven, and they're just herded over here and herded over there, and everything is emotion, emotion, emotion. And nobody knows, nobody teaches, nobody understands anymore that you are supposed to be in control of your emotions, not the other way around. And as a result, you have people, when you look at it, and you're like, okay, so people said you were fat and ugly on Facebook and called you names, and you couldn't handle that. What kind of state is a person in when that consumes them? And you put that up against somebody dealing with a real trauma, such as King David facing the death of this child. That's a real trauma. Not people calling you whatever names on the internet. This was a real trial. And you look at the way, and I think everybody, I think we can really take an example. This is how you conduct yourself, and this is how you feel these emotions without letting them control you, without letting your emotions take over your decision-making process. Anyway, I hope you got something out of it. And again, 2 Samuel chapter 12, read the whole story. One of the things I really appreciate about the historical record of the Old Testament is that they don't color code. They don't sugarcoat. I'll spit it out. They don't sugarcoat anything. You know, they don't make David in 2 Samuel chapter 12. They don't make David the innocent victim here. It's all laid out bare. You know, that he did this really, really ugly, awful thing, and that there were consequences from, and the consequences went beyond the child dying. There were consequences from this that stretched on well beyond this. He almost lost his entire kingdom over it. But again, get a chance, go ahead and read that chapter. It's a good stuff. There's a lot of good stuff, of course, obviously. Unfortunately, you know, the churches kind of ignore the Old Testament anymore. But anyway, I hope you got something out of it. I hope you enjoyed the entire show. I hope you'll get a chance to catch all of our content. And as always, I hope to see you back here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.